CITR 101.9 FM presents News 101, Vancouver's volunteer-produced student and community newscast.
Now here's your host, Andrew Longhurst.
Thank you for joining us this evening. First on the program, we speak with UBC reporters Samantha Jung, Paul Bucci, and Charlize Gordon. Here they are. Here is Samantha Jung.
Hi, I'm Samantha Jung for Paul Bucci and Charlize Gordon, and this is the UBC's Top Stars. On December 19th, a UBC student was stabbed at the McDonald's on University Boulevard. According to CBC, the University RCMP detachment was called at about 5:15 a.m. to the University Village and found a man suffering from stab wounds. He was treated at Vancouver General Hospital and was released before Christmas. It is one of the only places open late, and people tend to congregate there after hours, said an RCMP representative. Mostly calls are noise and disturbance related, and occasionally police attend for reports of people fighting. However, a former employee said, "The University McDonald's is one of the safest in the Lower Mainland, and I always had a good time there as far as safety was concerned."
The University of Victoria Student Society, or UVSS, voted in early December to send a letter to the AMS in support of the UN complaint filed in November. Edward Pullman, UVSS Director of Finance, put forward the motion to the UVSS Council. Pullman said, "Given that Canada is a signatory to the Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, it seems perfectly logical to recognize and publicize failures to uphold articles within this covenant."
A National Post story last week had the prerogative headline, "Frat Houses Evict Students to Cash In on Vancouver Olympics," which alleged that more than 200 students at the University of British Columbia are being forced out of their rooms by their own fraternities. While a number of fraternities are renting out their rooms during the month of February, fraternities are claiming the story is misleading and that members knew when signing their residence contract that they would have to leave in February. "We knew well in advance that this was going to happen, so we've been doing everything we can to make sure there are no issues," said Adam Madison, house manager of Deke. Also, he added that Deke members were consulted about the proposal as far back as last spring, and that all residents will see their rent lowered for January, March, and April, in addition to not paying for February.
The UBC Farm has been listed as Tides Canada's most innovative and forward-thinking organizations for 2009. Tides Canada is an organization that provides financial and management services for what they call changemakers. Their website says that they chose the UBC Farm for their leadership in research and learning about sustainable agriculture, climate change, food security, and community health, their interactive programs that educate students and adults, and for their urban Aboriginal programming, which supports over 700 participants, teaching them to live sustainably. Also included in the top 10 are Canadian Youth Climate Coalition and the Living Oceans Society.
UBC has partnered with Xerox Global Services in a move that the university says will reduce the university's energy consumption and carbon footprint. The six-year partnership with the Global Print Management Service will save the university approximately $8 million. Initial benefits include consistent, affordable, and reliable campus-wide printing and document production capabilities, said UBC VP Finance Pierre Wiyer. The objective will be to deliver cost savings and productivity improvements directly to the facilities, departments, and students at UBC. For Samantha Jung, Charlize Gordon, this is Paul Bucci.
And now we'll take a short PSA break, but stay with us next. Following the PSA break, we have coverage of the AIDS protest, which happened in Vancouver at the Vancouver Art Gallery.
Do you like having fun and winning cool prizes? Then you gotta check out the Sustainability Television 2009 Youth Media Contest.
Sustainability Television and the Sierra Club of BC want your creative, fun, and inspiring poems and essays with pictures or videos describing what you're doing to make your community more sustainable.
There are tons of totally rad prizes to be won. In addition to cash prizes, sponsor prizes include a $10,000 25-day river excursion, a recycled PC laptop, passes to Y Yoga and Semper Viva Yoga, organic grocery delivery from Spud, as well as visits for you and a friend to Whistler's Zip Trek Eco Tours, and much, much more.
The contest runs until January 9th, 2010, but the sooner you enter, the more likely you are to win. Check out sustainabilitytelevision.com for full details. And tell us what you're doing.
Stewie, hey.
Hey there.
So, it's been 24 hours. Got my money?
Oh, you know what? Just give me till next Friday. I'll have it for you.
Oh, that's funny. I could have sworn I said have it today.
Yeah, I don't have it. Sorry.
Oh, well, all right then. That's good, OJ. Yeah, that hurt. That hurt.
What the hell?
Yeah, it feels so good.
Thank you to all the donors who pledged their financial support during the CITR on-air fund drive. We are moved by your generosity, and thank you for enabling us to purchase new equipment and improve our programming. Do remember to stop by the station, pay your pledges, and pick up your prizes. We look forward to meeting you anytime between 10 a.m. and 6 p.m. on weekdays. Thank you again for your amazing response. Listen to our happy voices on the air, happier after we purchase new equipment for our studios. Thanks again.
You got till 5 o'clock. You hear me? You got till 5 o'clock.
You freaking psychopath!
Clean yourself up.
Thank you for being with us this evening. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. Right now, we have an interview with David Swan, Executive Director of AIDS Vancouver, and reporter Brad Pepping brings us this interview from December 18th.
Vancouver Art Gallery was host to a Rubescent demonstration this afternoon as activists, community groups, and politicians joined in public protest against government cuts to local HIV/AIDS service providers. I spoke earlier today with David Swan, and here's what he had to say. So on the line, I have David Swan, Executive Director of AIDS Vancouver. Thank you for joining me, Mr. Swan.
Thank you for giving me some time.
I was hoping for those who weren't able to participate in the demonstration today at the Vancouver Art Gallery, maybe you could just walk us through what happened.
Absolutely. There was a turnout of about 60 people on the steps of the front of the Art Gallery. Spencer Herbert, MLA for the West End, from the NDP, spoke. And we were protesting the current raft of funding cuts that are coming down from the Ministry of Health through the health authorities, and particularly Vancouver Coastal Health Authority. So it's a three-phase cut process. They've just announced phase one cuts for December 1st, a bit of irony in that it was World AIDS Day. And they announced that AIDS Vancouver is being cut in the first round $263,000, which for an agency our size is astronomical. One new infection, according to the Ministry of Health, one new infection of HIV/AIDS in this province costs us $250,000. So if there's one new infection in the month of December as a result of that, they've canceled out what they've saved in this agency.
And so maybe you could speak to us about what it is that your organization accomplishes and what that money would have been spent on.
Absolutely. AIDS Vancouver is one of the oldest agencies in the country. We are in our 26th year. We have a staff of about 25 people and a volunteer base of 150 people. We have a case management program with seven registered social workers who see about 1,200 distinct individuals a year. We have a grocery program that runs 2 or 3 weeks out of the month. And each week we see between 600 and 700 people that we feed. We have a support program with 50 volunteers who are matched one-to-one with people providing practical and emotional support. And we have a prevention education department that goes out across Vancouver and the Lower Mainland providing workshops, trainings, and speakers on HIV/AIDS.
Today I also had the chance to speak with Spencer Herbert, MLA for Vancouver West End, who addressed the crowd at the Vancouver Art Gallery about the funding cuts. Here's what he had to say.
Today was a day of a whole bunch of groups, community-based health organizations, which work in the AIDS field, gathered to speak out against the BC Liberals' cuts to AIDS prevention programs. We've seen cuts, for AIDS Vancouver as an example, of about $250,000 cut from their budget. That'll affect their ability to do all the programs they do, as well as, I believe, these kinds of cuts will just cost the healthcare system more in the long run. And I say that because if you're able to prevent just one infection of HIV, you're saving the healthcare system $250,000. And so all of these agencies, whether it be AIDS Vancouver, Youth Co-Aid Society, Native Health, BCPWA, Dr. Peter Center, all these groups do really crucial work in AIDS prevention as well as AIDS care, and they're getting chopped.
And so I guess kind of what you've touched on is the difference between prevention and treatment.
That's right.
And so do you think that there is quite a large role for the province to play in that type of prevention? Do you think that the responsibility should still lie with them funding it, or should it come through these types of organizations?
Well, I think the healthcare system, you know, it's the province where the buck stops. It's the government who, in the end, sets up how we're supposed to address healthcare. And prevention should be one of our key goals as a province, because if you can stop the problem today, it's going to save you way more money down the road than if you just let the problem get worse. And we've seen that in all walks of life. You know, there are cuts to addiction services, there are cuts to senior services, there are cuts to frontline health services, all have an impact on what happens later. You know, you could even take that further to look at the level of poverty amongst children. We know the social determinants of health show that if you keep people in poverty, the chances are of their health being worse than if you actually address those issues early on and help them get out of that situation. You're going to be saving yourselves money. You know, you could even take that to homelessness and the number of homeless people on the street. It costs the government more to keep people on the street than it does to get them housed, just because the legal costs, the police costs, the health care costs, etc. So we need to be thinking proactively if we're going to deal with the healthcare crisis we've got in this province, and that's what we were speaking out about today at the rally at the Art Gallery with all the community-based health organizations.
Okay, and not sure if you caught this, but recently it came out that VANOC is going to be providing around 100,000 free condoms for
the athletes.
The athletes, as well as the executives who are going to be in the athletes' village. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if maybe you could comment on that.
Well, what I've heard before is that at athletes' villages, they are definitely a center of potential infection. You've got a whole bunch of people very excited. New country, new place, coming together, and we've got to be doing as much as we can to ensure people are using best practices and being safe. And there's a huge range of people from all different cultural backgrounds in different places. So I know VANOC or the Olympics has done that before. It's actually a very small campaign this time in Beijing. They had quite a large campaign to both educate the population as well as the athletes. VANOC really dropped the ball on that, and so did the provincial government. They had committed to making a bigger deal, but they didn't this time, and that's unfortunate because it was a great way of reaching out to people who might not be connected through traditional means to healthcare information and prevention information, and by working with athletes, you can reach a whole another group of people to encourage them to use condoms and that kind of thing.
I also had the chance to ask David Swan what he thought about VANOC delivering 100,000 condoms to Olympic athletes.
The irony is right to me that Vancouver Coastal Health is putting energy behind providing safer sex messaging and free condoms to elite athletes from around the country, and at the same time sending out a message that BC is the best place on earth. And at the same time, they've announced cuts to HIV/AIDS organizations across the Lower Mainland. The irony of that is outrageous. As you say, at Beijing and Salt Lake City, the focus of the host cities in HIV/AIDS was campaigns not only for international visitors, but for the local population. So it's interesting to me that BCH's response has been only within what they refer to as the Olympic family. As a result, a coalition of community-based organizations, broad-based, not just aid service organizations, but quite a few others, are pulling together a campaign called Safer Games, in which we'll be sending volunteers all across the city, going into bars, restaurants, venues, talking to tourists, talking to locals about harm reduction, safer sex, safer alcohol use, safer drug use.
And so I guess just one of my last questions for you is if people hear about what's happening and this is something that is shocking to them, is there anything that they could do to kind of help out what's going on?
Absolutely. We would really appreciate it. We set up a website, www.cancelthecut.org. If people could go on the website, there's email letter that they can sign on to and send directly to the Premier. We've got about 400 letters to date. We're hoping for 1,000 by New Year's. And people can can adjust the letter to their own preferences or just send it as it is, and it just says to the Premier, this is unacceptable. Our province used to be one of the leaders in HIV/AIDS. We had the first organization in the country. This province was the first government to actually fund the treatments. Shocking to me that 26 years down the road and on World AIDS Day, they would announce that they are cutting, hoping to repatriate services back into the government where they can't provide them as cheaply or as efficiently as we do. With 150 volunteers, we provide about $300,000 bonus added in terms of resources that the government simply can't. So it's just a letter to the Premier that if people could send in and tell them to reverse these cuts.
Right. Well, thank you very much for speaking with me today.
No, thank you so much for the time. I appreciate it.
And thank you to Brad Pepping for bringing us that coverage. Now we're going to go to a public service announcement, but stay with us. We have a live interview with Hedy Fry, MP from Vancouver Centre.
Well-known pimp, narcotics king, big-time racketeer, back in full force.
This could be one of the big moments in your life. Don't make it your last.
Look, this thing might be bigger than even we think it is.
Do you need an upgrade to the soundtrack to your life? Maybe a song from a film or a tune from TV? Radio Free GAC brings you sounds of the cinema, along with the songs that will be defining your future and the forgotten classics that need a little rescue.
Come on, baby. Come on. I won't let you down. Follow me.
Radio Free GAC. Monday evening, 7:30 till 9 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Another night's work well done. And so easy without that nuisance Spider-Man.
I didn't know you cared.
You!
Yes, Electro. And I'm going to short-circuit you once and for all.
You would have been better off in the hands of the police. You are no match for my power.
It takes more than power to win. It takes brains and knowing your enemy.
I'll pit my power against your brains any day. What was that?
That, my thieving fiend, is the result of brains.
Use your brain. Turn off all the lights when you leave a room. If every household in BC turned off one light bulb for 4 hours a day for 1 year, it would save enough electricity to power all the homes in Mission for an entire year. This Power Smart Play brought to you by BC Hydro Power Smart and CITR 101.9 FM.
CITR loves its friends. Having a Friends of CITR card entitles you to awesome discounts from businesses in your community. Maybe downtown is your stomping ground. Present your CITR card at 212 Productions Limited, Beat Street Records, Woo Vintage Clothing, Hits Boutique, Dream Apparel and Articles for People, Scratch Records, The Fall Tattooing, Flaming Angel Designs, Spank Clothing, Heart and Soul, Pacific Cinema Tech, and True Value Vintage, and receive great discounts. So become a CITR member, get a free Friends card, and feel the love.
I wanna love you. And treat you right. I wanna love you.
Recently, Prime Minister Stephen Harper prorogued Parliament, and it will be suspended until after the Winter Olympics this spring in Vancouver. On the line with us now, live, is Dr. Fry. She is the Member of Parliament for Vancouver Centre. Thank you for being with us, Dr. Fry.
It's my pleasure, Andrew.
Now, tell me, how did you first feel when you found out that the Prime Minister was actually going to prorogue Parliament?
Well, my first feeling was, not again. This is going to be the second time in a year that the Prime Minister has prorogued Parliament. It's going to be the third time in 4 years that he has called Parliament to a halt, first for an election and then twice for prorogation. Prorogation is not something that you do at the flick of a wrist. It's not something that you abuse, as the Prime Minister seems to be abusing it. And so I think it shocked me a little bit, because I think, you know, what it has really done was to say that Parliament doesn't matter, that Parliament is superfluous, and the work that Parliament does is superfluous, because for a whole year, the Prime Minister decided that there were important things he wanted to get done, important bills he wanted to pass. 35 of them are now gone. So it meant that for a whole year, all of the work that Parliament did has been nullified. It is as if a year was wasted. And it's because this Prime Minister seems to have whims, and they are all whims to get him out of trouble. And that's what bothers me. I think it's about the fact that the democratic institution of Parliament has now become useless in the Prime Minister's eyes.
Well, and you just touched on the fact that a lot of the work that Parliament has done over the past few months and longer will basically be void. A number of bills will have to be reintroduced and go through Parliament, and this is not something that happens at the flick of a wrist. This is something that takes time. What are some specific bills and legislation that you, as a member of Parliament, would have liked to have seen passed?
Well, it isn't what I would have liked to have seen passed. The Prime Minister berated the opposition for not supporting his bills. He brought them forward, and finally, with some amendments, opposition supported them so that they passed, or they were going to pass the House of Commons. Committees have been working on these bills. I mean, one of them is a bill on child pornography. Another one is a bill on consumer safety, new product safety for consumers. And we know that with consumers getting cheaper products from all around the world, the need to protect Canadians from, you know, faulty materials, from you know, all kinds of additives to food, etc. All of that has gone. It isn't happening anymore. Having said this, and even the legislation on white collar crime, increasing the penalties for white collar crime, which as we have seen with the meltdown globally of the banking industry, etc., and of many businesses, and in fact, there is a lot of white collar crime that needs to be looked at. That's all gone. That's not going to happen now. We're going to have to start from scratch all over again. And for 3 months, Parliament will be cooling its heels, not meeting, not doing anything. And because this Prime Minister decided that, you know, he can snap his fingers and stop it. I think the worst thing of all is that every time the Prime Minister has either called an election, when he promised that he would not call an election for 4 years, and he called one within a year, the second time when the 62% of Parliament, which is a majority in Parliament, agreed that they felt that he was not responding to the recession, that he didn't believe there was a recession. He had no plan. If you recall last January, he went off and he prorogued Parliament. So every time this Prime Minister thinks he's in trouble, he calls Parliament off. It's not only that he is acting in what I consider to be a petulant and almost an imperialistic manner, but the fact is that he only does it when he's in trouble, and it is one way of in fact not being accountable to the people of Canada for anything, because the people of Canada's power and authority rests in Parliament, and he is a minority government with 62% of the people who are not in his government, and that 62% do not have any way now for the next 3 months of asking this Prime Minister and his government to be accountable for anything that they do. And the big reason right now, we all know, is because of the Afghan detainees. The fact that he said that they didn't know anything about it, that the Minister of Defense says nobody knew, now we found out that other people knew, and this backing down, this is trying to stop the committee that was currently meeting from getting the information that they needed to get. Shutting down Parliament, that committee no longer exists. So that committee cannot meet.
And can you comment briefly, in December, that committee that was supposed to meet and the Conservative members did not, they essentially boycotted that committee meeting. Can you comment on that?
Well, it was one way, again, of the Prime Minister not wanting to be accountable. And you know what? You can say, all right, you know, that's what politics is about, not being accountable. I don't believe that that's what politics is about. But what is even worse is that this is a man who ran on accountability. He said, I am going to be accountable. I'm going to be bringing about all kinds of measures that will deal with this government in an ethical manner. I will be accountable to the people. I will answer to them. And now he's doing everything not to have to answer to the people, either through the House of Commons or through a committee. He is stopping the truth from getting out. This is outrageous. I mean, he has done it on every occasion, even when the parliamentary officer says that he has failed, that he has failed to give us the right amount of money in terms of his accounting as to what the deficit would be, and that the deficit would be even larger than the Prime Minister's finance minister has said. These kinds of things, he then stops the person from speaking out. He does everything he can to shut things down. You've seen that the Auditor General has had many things to say about how his government has been responsible and accountable. He is shutting her down. All of these things mean that when Parliament isn't meeting and committees are not meeting, that the truth is being shut down. Look at pension reform. Here was a man who said he cared about pension reform. That we see there are many, many, many people whose pensions, both private pensions, public pensions, and people who have put aside money in their RRSPs that have lost a lot of their money. These are seniors who now have nowhere to turn. They can't go back to work. So he said he cared about this. He doesn't, because he shut it all down again.
It's gone. With this prorogation, though, does the Governor General have to take any responsibility for this? The position is symbolic in nature, but at some point, does she need to act in the best interest of this country and say, "No, I'm not granting you that prorogation"?
Well, I am not a legal scholar, so I don't really know. But constitutionally, when the Prime Minister prorogued the last time, the Governor General had a huge amount of say in whether he did or not, because he was doing so because the 62% of Parliament had shown a lack of confidence in his actions and in the way he was running the country. So the Governor General had to make a decision about whether she would allow him to escape that accountability or not, whether she would allow him to continue to be the Prime Minister in spite of the fact that 62% of the people of the Parliament had decided they did not trust him anymore. And she made a decision to let him stay. In this instance, because there have been no votes of non-confidence against this government, because no saying we do not trust you or we don't have confidence in you, she doesn't have to give an answer at all. He can just do what he wishes and just let her know he's doing it. So in this instance, I understand from some of the constitutional scholars that she did not really have a say. She was just told that that was what he was going to do. But I think what we see here is a loss of democracy. Parliament is the democratic. We are a parliamentary democracy. We are not like the United States. We're not a republic. In a parliamentary democracy, the majority of people in Parliament have a say and should have a say on how a minority government functions. And in this instance, there are 62% of us, three opposition parties, who do have a majority in Parliament. Now, this Prime Minister has silenced that majority voice. He has silenced the voice of the people. He has silenced democracy. Second thing about it that I think he's also given as his reason, the first one, of course, we all know, is not wanting to be accountable for what has happened with the Afghan detainees, of the fact that now many people who are working in defense have said that they knew about it. We're hearing the truth coming out. He wishes to silence that truth. The second thing is he says that his bills cannot pass the Senate because there is a majority of senators who are not conservative. So he now is going to take this time off to create senators who are conservative, so the conservatives would have a majority in the Senate. Now, that goes against everything he has always said about appointing senators. This is a man who seems to think that when he wants something, he will go against what he said before. He will do what he wishes to do in order to have his own way. If it's not imperialistic, I have no idea what is.
Is this not reminiscent of the Bush years and their approach to government?
Well, I don't really want to compare the Prime Minister to somebody else. All I want to say is that, you know, when we saw even Mr. Mulroney, Joe Clark, other prime ministers who were not liberal, who had the things to do, they faced the music, they went on with it, they allowed Parliament to be the democratic institution that Canadians need to look at in terms of this country. This is the one prime minister who doesn't do this. You know, everyone is silenced. Parliament is now silenced. It's the final voice that is being silenced by this Prime Minister. Many people, we've had Olympics in this country before. No one if his other argument is the Olympic Games are on. I don't see any other Prime Minister who has ever taken time off just because we have an Olympics in town.
That's a great question. Are the Olympics being used for the sole purpose of the Prime Minister to run from the workings of Parliament? Is this something that's completely being used for his own gain?
Well, he has been given three reasons. One is the Olympics. He's given three reasons. One is the Olympics. The second one is the Senate that is not his, so he's going to make it his. The third one is the fact that he says he has to write an economic plan. Now, this is extraordinary. The Prime Minister takes time off and cancels Parliament so he can write an economic plan. Where has he been this last year? Sleeping? Did he not know that there has been a recession? Did he not know that there are over 700,000 jobs lost in this country in the last year? Does he not know that nothing that he has done in the past year will stand in terms of helping people to find jobs, to do any of the things he said he would do? He's now thinking of writing an economic plan? This is incompetence. Mm. So what you have, one, is a prime minister who stifles democracy in this country. Two, refuses to be accountable to the people of Canada for certain things that people are holding against him and asking him to answer by shutting down Parliament and committees. And finally, he's saying that he needs to have every one of his bills passed, so he's going to make it a Conservative Senate. And so he's taking this time off to create a new Senate, to bring in all kinds of people that he thinks will do what he wants them to do. I have no idea. You know, one can look at what a dictatorship is, and one can ask yourself if we are living in a monarchy in which the monarch does what he wishes, as they did in the old days, that the Prime Minister should so flout parliamentary democracy and should so flout the will of Parliament and the will of the people by doing what he chooses and by silencing anyone who would question him or ask him. This is extraordinary. I don't think Canada has ever had this done in the whole of its history.
But do you think there will be sufficient backlash from this prorogation that will translate into increased support for opposition parties, including the Liberal Party?
I don't see it happening. I mean, this holiday season, I was out, I was talking to various people. No one seems to even know how to spell prorogation, never mind what it means. What it means is unilaterally shutting down the work of Parliament and all of its committees, taking off the table the bills that are in discussion at the moment. So 35 pieces of legislation have gone. So that is really what prorogation means. But people don't seem to care. And I think that the reason that people don't seem to care is that everyone is still trying to make ends meet. People are still looking for work. I mean, there are many people, the Prime Minister likes to say, who are working. Many of them are working part-time jobs. They're just barely making ends meet in many instances, especially middle-income Canadians, who we know from all of the surveys that have been done about one paycheck away from bankruptcy. People with small children who have just bought a house and are paying enormous mortgages, who need to have two incomes. These people are suffering, and everyone is busy just trying to make ends meet, and so they're not noticing. And the Prime Minister has used the recession and used the economic downturn to actually do what he wishes, because he knows that people are not paying attention.
When do you think, though, that citizens will make the connection between their government and their own life and their own wallet, and see that, like the NDP has suggested, we need very significant EI reforms. We need to see increased benefits for those who are unemployed right now. Are people going to start to make these connections to see prorogation means that many of these things won't be addressed, or is it completely, are the issues divorced from each other? Well,
no, I think when people begin to hurt and when they begin to realize that they are now no longer able to, as we again have heard in some economic surveys, people are living off credit cards. When those credit cards become too full to live off, and two, when people are basically just, you know, scraping by and just paying the necessary bills, I think then people may pay attention. Because we read in the paper that everything is getting better, and those people still don't have work. And so I don't understand how things can get better until people get work, until people get the ability to be able to keep their families safe and to keep their homes and to have jobs. And so the NDP may at the same time say that there is so much work to be done, but it is the NDP who propped up this government when they brought in what I call a sham of an EI bill in September. The NDP voted for it. It was a bill that did not even help all of those 50-year-old workers that it was meaning to help in places like, for instance, British Columbia, where your pine beetles decimated the forests, where there is no salmon in the river, where people cannot work even if they try. That bill is not helping them. And yet the NDP supported it. So, you know, the NDP may well talk about EI reforms. They had an opportunity to vote very strongly against what was a sham bill and to put in strong EI reforms, and they're not doing it. And the EI reforms have fallen off the table now that we've prorogued.
Right. Well,
so, you know, the NDP can't have it both ways either.
Right. But in some sense, that was a strategic move for them, because they knew that the public didn't want to be thrown into an election.
You know what? The NDP has always got a reason for doing what it does. It says one thing and it does another, as we saw in the, you know, in the election in 2005 when the NDP voted to bring down the Martin government. Mr. Martin had met with Mr. Layton in the October before the NDP voted to bring down the government. He said, we've got three things that I would hope that you would give us time to come in February with the budget so that these things that I know you want will be cemented in the budget. After that, you can do what you want about bringing down the government, that at least they would be cemented in the budget and the government would not be able to write it off because Parliament would have voted on it. And that was, one, the Kelowna Accord, two, a national housing strategy, and three, a national childcare strategy. And Mr. Layton thought that it was not particularly strategic for him to do it, so he brought down the government, losing all three. And then he begins to complain about the fact that we have no housing strategy and no national daycare and how Aboriginal people are not being given any of the things that they need for education and housing. So you can't have it both ways. There's some time or the other when you've got to have some principles.
I want to backtrack just quickly and ask you about Bill C-46. And the Investigative Powers for the 21st Century Act. And if you could just comment briefly on that legislation that now will need to be reintroduced if it is going to go through the House of Commons.
Well, we'll have to see if that legislation is even introduced. It's really moot to speak about anything because we don't know if it'll come back. Yeah. I mean, this government will decide what it wants to do when it feels that it's the thing that it wants to do to take people's attention away from something else, throws up pieces of legislation that catches people's eyes. Well, maybe that they don't need that eye-catching legislation anymore. I think, you know, one can't comment on it because it's all gone. It's moot, and only the government can bring it back because, you know, well, not the government, but, I mean, the private members' bills are all off the table. Right. They have to be reintroduced again.
And just
everything is gone.
Right. And finally, I want to ask you, are we ready for a spring election? There's quite a bit of speculation right now that we could be seeing one. Is the Liberal Party ready?
You know what? I think that what I know that the Liberal Party is ready to do is to talk about moving forward to get ourselves out of the economic trouble we're in. I don't think we want to see an election if we feel that that will be done on the backs of we think we can do better. Obviously, we think we can. But spending $300 million for an election is not on the table right now when we still have, you know, so many people with no jobs and when we still have no vision for the future, no plan, no anything that will move us forward. And we were hoping that we would be able to get back and do some of that. That's not going to happen. We're cooling our heads until the 5th of March.
So what will you be doing, Dr. Fry, between now and the Parliament resuming following the Winter Games?
What I do, which is I would be meeting, I have round tables all the time. I meet with seniors, I meet with housing advocates, I meet with businesses, I meet with women's groups. I meet with people to talk about transportation communities. I mean, one is concerned about where British Columbia is going to go in terms of having an Asia-Pacific gateway to move our goods and services. I mean, these are things I meet about all the time. I listen to people. I listen to what they're advising us to do, and I send that back as chair of BC Caucus to take it back to the leader, and I say to him, this is what we're feeling, this is what people are thinking, this is what people are suggesting, these are what people are advising, because we have to have a plan. Whatever happens, we have to at least know what we're doing. But at the same time, I think we're all very distressed and disturbed that this man, this prime minister, has absolutely no respect for Parliament and is not accountable to the people, and continues to run away and hide by closing down shop whenever he gets asked questions that he finds uncomfortable.
And what are your priorities as Member of Parliament for Vancouver Centre in the new session?
Well, the economy is a priority right now. I know that there are many middle-income Canadians. You know, you take young people who are just out of university, they're sort of in their 30s, and they've just, both of them are working, they've got jobs that may be paying $70,000 each or $50,000 each, and they can cope with those two of them working. They just bought a little condo, they're thinking of having a kid. These are the people I worry about. I also worry about all of the seniors in my riding, and I have a lot of seniors in my riding, who don't know what the heck they're going to live on, because all of their RSPs and the pensions that they thought, and those who are about to retire who thought they had pensions, who find out that the companies that they worked for spent the pension money or don't have pensions for them. I'm worried about these people. What are they going to do? You know, we don't have any housing. Rental housing is absolutely zero. Negative rental housing in this city. I mean, I'm concerned about other things. These are the real bread and butter things that we should be concerned about. That's what Parliament should be meeting, to try and look at those things that affect ordinary people in their ordinary lives. It's one thing to talk about massive amounts of wondrous trade and all that, but trade, if it creates jobs, is a good thing. And we need to look at how we can do that to create jobs. We need to look at creating jobs, or at helping, stimulating job creation, looking at how we deal with the fisheries that's gone down, which is a huge thing, at one-fifth of the BC economy in forestry that is no longer viable. What are we doing about this? What are we doing on research and development? What are we doing for education? What are we doing for the youth who are coming out of university who are not going to have any jobs to come to? Those are the things that I worry about.
Well, thank you, Dr. Fry. We appreciate you speaking to CITR.
Very much. Thank you very much.
Take care.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
That was Liberal MP Hetty Fry in a conversation with me, your host, Andrew Longhurst. Now with your weekday forecast, weather forecast is Daniel Casanova of UBC's Storm Club. We're now going to take a quick break, but stay tuned. Next, we bring you coverage of the firebombing which took place today at a Hamilton mosque.
The UBC Ski and Snowboard Club is a nonprofit, democratic, student-run organization dedicated to promoting the sports of skiing and snowboarding and the associated lifestyle.
We endeavor to make skiing and snowboarding accessible and fun by actively seeking out the best deals and discounts for our members, as well as organizing trips to local ski areas and setting up numerous social events.
Come on one of our legendary trips and explore the glory of riding in British Columbia. Or join us at the bar to discover the true meaning of debauchery. Ask your roommate, ask your parents, ask the RCMP. Who has the most fun at UBC? You'll get the same answer. The Ski and Snowboard Club.
Yeah. Joining the Ski and Board Club is easy. Come by our office, sub 115, anytime with some money to become a member. Your membership gives you access to all the deals offered by our sponsors, cheap beverages at our parties, an invitation to all club events, and of course, only members can come on the trips. Yeah.
Now with your weekday weather forecast is Daniel Casanova of UBC's Storm Club. Daniel?
Hello. Here's your weekday forecast for January 4th to January 8th. The new school term kicked off with a nasty day of rain, but it should be lightening up over the night. There's a high-level ridge off the coast, which should provide a break in cloud cover later in the week. We are still receiving air from the mid-Pacific, which will keep daytime high temperatures mild throughout the week, hovering around 6 degrees. Low temperatures decreasing to negative 2 degrees at the end of the week. Monday evening to the overnight, cloudy with 70% chance of drizzle, with a low of 5 degrees. Tuesday, cloudy with 30% chance of showers, high of 7 degrees. Wednesday, cloudy with sunny periods, 30% chance of showers in the morning, with clearing skies in the afternoon, high of 5 degrees. Thursday, we'll have sunny periods with a high of 5 degrees. Friday, cloudy periods with 40% chance of showers, high of 5 degrees. It's not the greatest conditions to start the new term, but after all this rain we've had, a little snow is starting to look pretty good right about now. Currently, it is 6 degrees with light drizzle at YVR. That's your weather this week, brought to you by the UBC Storm Club. For News 101, I'm Daniel Casanova.
Thank you, Daniel. This is News 101, and the current time is 5:45. Thank you for being with us tonight. Earlier today at a mosque in Hamilton, the Hamilton Mosque was the victim of a suspected hate crime. I spoke with Executive Director of the Council on American Islamic Relations Canada to get his perspective on today's firebombing. A little bit about the incident at the Hamilton Mosque.
Okay, from what we know from the reports, a rock was thrown through the window of the mosque sometime after midnight, and some form of a Molotov cocktail was either thrown or placed inside the window.
Okay. And as far as we know at this point, police don't have any suspects in mind?
At this point, the Hamilton Police Hate Crime Unit and arson investigators have been called, as well as uniformed officers who will be reviewing the surveillance videos from the buildings and the area. But at this point, I don't think that they have any particular suspects in mind.
Now, have these types of incidents and hate crimes occurred before, not specifically in Hamilton, but across Canada and other Canadian cities?
Absolutely. CareCan is one of the organizations that works on behalf of Canadian Muslims, and we receive reports of these types of incidents on a regular basis.
And is this type of incident, is this compared to previous incidents, how does this, on a scale, how does this, I don't want to say rank, but is this a more mild incident in terms of the, no one was injured, no one was hurt, or is this a pretty big indicator that this is on the rise?
Look, Andrew, I also hesitate to quantify these kinds of incidents because any incident of vandalism is deeply offensive and hurtful, in regardless of its scope or scale. As you said, thankfully nobody was hurt, and in this incident, the fire only caused minor damage, but the scale of the damage that could have resulted from this type of attack is concerning. This is something that, it represents an incident that should still draw attention. And while it's disturbing, however, we don't believe that these types of incidents represent the sentiments of the majority of Canadians.
Are these types of hate crimes, are they more common in the United States, or are they on the rise in Canada's?
Well, for incidents in the United States, you'd have to check with organizations that work there in terms of statistics. And obviously, given that it is a much larger country with a higher population, I would expect that they would have a higher reported number of incidents than here in Canada. But this is the kind of thing that, all Canadians should be concerned with.
Do you believe this is a response to any particular actions by Canada abroad or other countries?
Andrew, I think it's probably difficult to speculate, and I wouldn't want to, about what the motivation behind this may or may not be. At this point, I think we don't have enough information to try and go there, and any type of comment on that would be pure speculation.
Have you received comments from concerned individuals or just general responses from people that are concerned about this? And how does your organization work? What do you do following some of these incidents? What is your sort of plan of action?
In terms of that, we have received feedback from the community expressing concern about this incident, as well as prior incidents. In terms of a response to this, we call on the local authorities as well as the local politicians to stand firm against this type of incident, as well as calling on our fellow Canadians to speak out against this type of cowardly act. With a plan going forward, we encourage other mosques as well as other faith-based centers to remain vigilant for other suspicious activities, and to report those to the proper authorities, as well as to CareCan, so that we can establish and demonstrate a clear record of these types of incidents.
So going forward, we'll be looking to hear from what the Hamilton Police Department finds in this investigation, and then from that point, bringing those people to justice. Is that where we're at this point?
I think that's about all we can say at this point going forward.
Okay. Well, great. Are there any other comments our listeners should be left with?
CareCan is encouraged that the Hamilton Police have called in the hate crimes unit in this incident, and we hope that there are no further types of incidents like this going forward.
Well, great. I appreciate your time, and we hope this does come to a close, some resolution.
Perfect. Thanks, Andrew.
Great. Thank you. Thank you to Asan Gardi of CareCan. It's now time for a PSA break. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
The Advocacy Office provides confidential and free representation, guidance, and assistance to students engaged in conflict with UBC. We advocate for students in preparing and attending formal meetings, hearings, and appeals against the university. Specifically, our office helps students with matters of student discipline, such as cheating, collaboration, or plagiarism, assigned standing, admissions, and financial assistance. We can also assist you in appeals to decisions made by UBC Library, parking, or housing. You are not alone. We're here to help. For more information, call 822-9855 or visit the website at www.ams.ubc.ca/advocacy.
Remember when you first learned about the birds and the bees? Want to learn more about the birds and the bees and the berries, urban agriculture, delicious homegrown food, solar energy, and much more? Check out the Society Promoting Environmental Conservation. Come to one of our workshops, join our solar panel tour, or go to our website, www.spec.bc.ca, for more information.
I'm Peter Mansbridge, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Last night, I left the bar. I was thirsty, and I don't drink wine. I was desperate. I needed blood. I turned to the only place I could, the only place that could possibly help me.
Hello, Canadian Blood Services.
Hello. I need some blood. A. Positive or negative, it doesn't matter.
I'm sorry, we're all out of A positive and negative. Would you like some O instead?
No. No, that won't do. Thank you. Good night. Save me. Save yourself. Give blood. Voluntarily.
This message was brought to you courtesy of the Canadian Blood Services and CITR Radio 101.9 FM.
Welcome back to News 101. I'm Andrew Longhurst, coming to you live from the Student Union Building at UBC. Thanks for being with us tonight. Right now, it's 5:54, and now Brad Pepping spoke to Carol Woods of Co-Development Canada about their upcoming local film festival.
Great. So on the line today, I have Carol Wood of Co-Development Canada, the program director at Co-Development Canada. Is that right?
Yes, it is. Hello.
How are you today?
I'm well, thanks.
I was hoping that you could describe for us the upcoming film festival that you're hosting here in Vancouver.
Absolutely. This is the 9th annual World Community Film Festival that CODEV has been hosting here in Vancouver. And we, along with a couple of other partners, gather together films about different social justice issues in Canada, around the world. And we bring them all together for one weekend at the end of January at Langara College. So we've got a really good lineup this year. We just got our program in a couple of days ago, and it's looking really great.
Okay, cool.
Mm-hmm.
So I was hoping to ask you, Vancouver is host to many festivals, many issue-based festivals throughout the year. I was wondering if you could talk to us about the ways in which the medium is used to attract the Vancouver public, and maybe, as you said, this is your 9th year, maybe you could talk to us about some of your successes, maybe some of your failures.
Yeah, absolutely. Co-Development Canada is an organization that works in Latin America doing social justice work and helping our partners in Latin America do social justice work. And our whole philosophy is really that we here in Canada have as much to learn from the struggles of people in Latin America as they do from us. So it's a real partnership approach to development. And I think when you look at a film festival like this, it's really just an extension of that idea. The idea that we can, as activists or just interested people here in Vancouver, by going to these films, we can learn about other people's struggles, and we can maybe get ideas, maybe get some insights, not only into the issues and the situations that people are going through in different parts of the world, but we can also look at how those issues and how those problems have been solved in other ways, and maybe they'll inspire us for our own, for our own struggles here in our own lives. So I think our film festival is unique in that it covers all different kinds of issues. We've got quite a bit this year on the extractives industry, so mining industries abroad as well as here. We have an excellent film on water as a human right, sort of it looks at bottled water. We've got a couple of different ones on the media. So it's a real range of social justice issues around the world. And as I say, I think it's really good for us all to try to learn from other people's struggles.
And so that brings us back to kind of this precarious time that the film festival is actually going to be here in Vancouver, because as we all know, the Olympics are hitting town. Is this by coincidence, or is there any way in which you were trying to connect these issues to what's happening in Vancouver more directly related to the Olympics?
Well, it's interesting that you say that. Now, normally our film festival is in February, so normally we're working on a bit longer of a timeline after Christmas, but because of the Olympics, we've actually had to bump it ahead a couple of weeks. We realized that there was just no possibility of any kind of media coverage in February. So it has affected us directly. I think in terms of the message to activists here in Vancouver who are interested in working on issues around the Olympics, there's always stuff that can be learned. We've got a couple of different films on corporations, on globalization. There's one on Coca-Cola that given that Coke is going to be launching their new sort of environmentally green pop bottle at the Olympics, I think it might be an interesting thing for people to see before they go off and buy their Coke at the Olympics. There's another one, Addicted to Plastic, that I think could also be pretty applicable. So it's I think it would be a great way for people to kind of start thinking about different issues before the whole Olympics mayhem starts up in February.
Well, thank you so much for speaking with me today. I do appreciate it.
And, you're so welcome.
Best of luck with the festival at the end of this month.
Sure, yes. It's the 29th to the 31st at Langara College, and our website is codev.org/filmfest. So thanks so much.
All right. Thanks so much.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye now.
And that's our program for January 4th, 2009. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, give us a hot news tip, or get involved with the show, contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email news@citr.ca. Brad Pepping produced this radio program. For more news, join us Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Andrew Longhurst. From the entire news team at CITR, thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Thunderbird Sports on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.